The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. On today's episode, we'll be talking about sex, specifically about the genetic and evolutionary aspects of sexual reproduction. Although modern internet dating may have convinced you that asexual reproduction is the way to go, there are several good reasons to adopt the two-party system, although peace of mind might not generally be among them. It is, however, a great way to combine your genes with someone else's in order to improve our chances of survival as a species, which is hot. Biologist John Logsdon will tell us all about it later on in the show, but first we have someone here to do a bit of speaking up. We're here today with Dawn Riefler, Direct Care Supervisor with the Carey Home for Children in Lafayette, Indiana, which provides residential care for at-risk youth. And he's also the co-founder of the Lafayette Skeptics. And in addition, he's heading up a new skeptical event, the Gen Con Guerrilla Skeptical Symposium. Welcome to Speaking Up, Dawn.
Thank you, Desiree.
And great name for an event, by the way.
Yeah, yes, I can't take credit for that. That's K.O. Myers from Grassroots Skeptics all the way.
That's definitely K.O. Mm. So first tell us about Gen Con proper.
Gen Con proper, ostensibly it's a gaming convention. When I say gaming, I mean you got to reach back to the roots, pen and paper, 20-sided dice, Dungeons and Dragons type of stuff. But in the last few years, it's grown to be a whole lot more than that. That's still technically its intended purpose. They call it the best 4 days in gaming, and it really is. But they also have video games every year. They're expanding their electronic stuff, comic books, sci-fi and fantasy. They have a humongous anime section. So it's basically, it's getting to be a lot like Dragon Con and Comic Con and all the big conventions. They're all kind of concentrating in on zooming in on this one formula, and that's Gen Con in a nutshell. Lots of dorks, geeks, and nerds.
Nice. Okay. So where does the guerrilla skepticism come in exactly?
Well, we don't have any official recognition from Gen Con. Hopefully we'll get to that eventually, but it all started back in 2008. Me and a couple of friends, Tom, Sean, and Rob, we were at Gen Con having a good time. We looked through the events catalog to see what we could do because we had some downtime, and we noticed a group called the Indianapolis Ghost Trackers. Maybe it's just the Indiana Ghost Trackers. In any case, some ghost hunters. They had an event, a seminar called, The Science of EVP. And we said, ooh, we have to go to that. And we did, and it was horrific. They had a couple of people giving this panel, and they didn't seem to know much about, you know, their own pseudoscience, much less actual science. So we asked a couple of pointed but very polite questions about Occam's razor and how they define theory. And as it turns out, they define theory to mean stuff we make up on the spot. And it was so bad, we said, okay, next year we got to do a panel for ourselves. So last year we gave just 1 2-hour panel, covered a lot of different stuff, basics of critical thinking, logical fallacies, talked about Bigfoot, ghost hunting, stuff like that. And we thought we were going to have maybe 10, 15 people. We had 40, maybe 50 people there. They really seemed to enjoy it. People said, I'm so surprised to see this kind of thing here. I'm so glad. And so this year we said, well, let's do it bigger. You know, let's see if we can get it bigger year by year. And because we still don't have any official recognition, because we're not that big yet, we are the Guerrilla Skeptical Symposium. We're coming in bottom up, doing our own thing, self-organizing, and hoping that at some point somebody will notice.
Oh, wonderful. So this is kind of patterned after the Dragon Con Skeptrack in that kind of form.
Yeah, in intent and design it is. We have panels and presentations, just as my understanding of their Skeptrack. I've never been down there because I don't make enough money. But they were the inspiration, to be sure. The only difference is that, you know, they have a bunch of, you know, so to speak, big names. And we're just a bunch of average Joe skeptics trying to do it on our own. So right now, yeah, we don't have anybody big. It's just some people trying to reach out and educate the public. But, you know, with enough attention, maybe someday we can have the bad astronomer or somebody. You never know.
Absolutely. And I did attend Dragon Con last year, and it was brilliant. It's a great model.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So what panels do you have planned?
Let's see. Well, right now, as it stands, we have six different presentations. Only one of them is technically a panel, because I guess everybody else just wanted to give independent talks. The panel itself is called Skepticism, Critical Thinking, and Pop Culture. And we have four, maybe five, maybe six people sitting on it. It's kind of up in the air. But that's just your kind of average intro to skepticism. And it's going to be totally audience driven. We're going to give them a list of stuff we've prepped and say, okay, what do you want us to talk about? And if somebody says Bigfoot, then we'll go talk about Bigfoot. And kind of that way we can riff on things and not make it. Last year was kind of a lecture and it got boring, so we said, well, we need to be more interactive this year, so it'll make it more of a panel. And let's see, we got a two-man talk, me and my friend Tom Foss, a talk called Cargo Cult Science in the Grand Tradition of Richard Feynman. We're going to talk about cargo cult as an analog for pseudoscience, or cargo cults, excuse me, as an analog for pseudoscience. One of our new recruits this year, Tristan Zimmerman, is doing a talk called Evolution, Creationism, and Gaming, which should be extra interesting because he's focusing less on evolution and creationism and more on how to insert different cosmologies and different ways to achieve biological diversity into a pen and paper role-playing game world. So that I'm kind of looking forward to. He's given that twice. Yes. And, you know, he hopes to, you know, educate some people on evolution and ID and such while he's doing it. But he's definitely making the context of gaming the big focus, where we learned last year that Gen Con will pretty much okay any event, and you don't have to pretend it's about gaming. So we're not even trying that anymore. So let's see, what else do we have? I'm giving a talk called Culture and the Paranormal, where I'm going to look at paranormal in different cultural contexts from around the world, and you know what we would expect to see if, say, crop circles really were aliens. We might expect to see them all over the place, but just as an example, we pretty much just see them in English-speaking countries. And it's going to be a talk kind of about how those patterns tend to indicate that the paranormal is mostly in our heads. We got a talk on financial scams. My friend Sean's giving that. Another one of our recruits named Sarah Head, who is, I believe, from Indianapolis, she's given a talk on archaeology and pseudo-archaeology. And the latest talk we've added to our roster, which we haven't officially scheduled yet because it just kind of got official in our heads the other day, is tentatively titled The Power of Immunization, and it's a pro-vaccine talk, which last year, yes, thank you. Last year, that was the biggest and most well-loved part of our panel, was the part we put together on the anti-vaccine movement. And I'd like to give a shout-out and thanks to Dr. Joe Albeats and Dr. Dave Gorski from Science-Based Medicine, who gave us a lot of information to help out with that last year. So that was great.
And you're also doing a fundraiser around immunization as well.
Yes, definitely. And that's why the talk about immunization just got solidified, because if the fundraiser didn't pan out the way we were hoping, we were just going to fold that into our panel. But we happen to have organized successfully a fundraiser to benefit the Indiana Immunization Coalition, who is working toward higher Indiana vaccination rates. And Indiana has pretty low rates. I want to say they're about 70% in some areas of the state. And as it turns out, my initial thought was that's got to be because we don't have the money. And as in fact, it's not that at all. Indiana has plenty of public money and funds to go to vaccinating children. Our low vaccination rates are due entirely to misinformation, most likely from the anti-vaccine movement. So our money will go 100% to the Indiana Immunization Coalition, who plans to use it to help spearhead new educational initiatives. And they were extremely excited when I called them, because apparently nobody's ever offered to raise money for them before. They just kind of have flown under the radar the last 10 years. So this will be good. We'll get their name out there, get them some publicity, and Gen Con loved the idea too. So we will be in a booth in their Family Fun Pavilion, which I am told is on one of the main drags by a couple of big vendors. I hope one of them is Wizards of the Coast, because that's about as you can get out at Gen Con. We will be trading amateur magic tricks for money and anything else we can think of to try to pull money from people. And we're going to be handing out educational materials, kind of pamphlets for the IIC, the Immunization Coalition. And then we're going to be giving that talk at least twice to try to spread awareness and get more people to vaccinate their kids, try to counter this anti-vax nonsense.
Wonderful. Really.
Thank you. Yes. I hope it goes well. I really do.
So when and where is this?
Gen Con is in Indianapolis, Indiana, and it is on August 5th through August 8th. That's a Thursday through a Sunday. We will be there. Our talks are scheduled throughout those 4 days, and we will be at the booth collecting donations all day, every day in the exhibit hall. That was part of the deal. Can't leave it unmanned. And if you want to find out, if you don't mind me plugging the website briefly.
Absolutely.
If you want to find out the schedule of events, we have a website at GenConSkeptics.com where I have summaries, detailed summaries about most of our talks, and I'm still working on putting the rest of them up. We have a schedule for the events we have currently submitted to Gen Con, and we have a list of stuff we still need because we could still use some volunteers, especially to help run the fundraising booth. So anybody that is interested or is going to be in Gen Con and would love to help, or would like to help out, we would love to have you. Just stop by GenConSkeptics.com. We have a contact form there, and you can get to us through that. And in addition to, if people just want to help volunteer at the table for the fundraiser, that's fantastic. We need as many people as we can get because at some point all the rest of us have to go give our talks and eat, and you know we'd like to actually see the convention and stuff. But you know we could work the table if we had to. But we like volunteers. What we would also love, absolutely love to have, is people who would help us expand our program because, like I said, we only have 6 or 7 different talks, and we're given a couple of them twice. But if we really want to get big, then we need to start as big as we can. So we would appreciate anybody who wants to give any kind of talk about cryptozoology or ghost hunting or any kind of pseudoscience. We're pretty much sticking with pseudoscience and staying away from the religion question, not because that's where I stand necessarily, but because I want Gen Con to approve our events. I don't want somebody to come in and you know give a speech about why there is no God, and then suddenly Gen Con doesn't want any of us to talk. So anybody with that has a panel idea, wants to give an individual presentation, 1 or 2 person presentation about anything skeptical or scientific, we would love to have you come by the website and contact us. But the deadline for event submission to Gen Con is the 13th of March. So if you're going to be there or if you want to come down and give a talk or a panel, you're going to have to get with us pretty quickly because we got to get that in and taken care of to make sure that we can actually get a room and a time scheduled for it.
Thanks so much for being here, Don. Oh, I love
thank
events
you for having
like this. Definitely.
Yeah, and I love publicity, so thanks.
No problem at all.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LP 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia. CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia. CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario. CLHI Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia. Freethought Radio and WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today we'll be talking about sex, genes, and evolution with John Logsdon, but first, I have a few announcements. In Washington, D.C., the Independent Investigations Group is holding a seminar. Ben Radford will be speaking about scientific paranormal investigations, how to solve unexplained mysteries. And that's on Saturday, March 13th at 1 p.m. And the seminar will be followed by the D.C. IIG kickoff. Now, I had IIG on the show a few episodes ago, and they're a fantastic group, and this is the opening of their new branch in D.C. For more information, head to centerforinquiry.net/DC. And another previous Skeptically Speaking guest, Aaron Santos, author of How Many Licks, the book that teaches you how to estimate damn near anything, is having an estimation contest. I have submitted a question, and it is awesome. I don't know if it's been posted yet, but it is, how many dice rolls in all the role-playing games in an average year? Huh? You can check out the contest for yourself at diaryofnumbers.blogspot.com, and it's under an entry titled Fermi Contest 2. And the last announcement is that Skeptically Speaking will be doing a live show from the Dragon Con Skeptrack stage. And I cannot begin to tell you how excited all of us are. Squealing was involved, and not actually necessarily from me. Dragon Con, the science fiction fantasy convention that is kind enough to allow a skeptical fan track. It isn't until September 3rd to 6th in Atlanta. So we and you have lots of time to prepare. More information on the awesomeness that is the Skeptrack can be found at skeptrack.org. And now to sex. John Logsdon is an associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa, but he's currently a sabbatical scholar at the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham, North Carolina, where he's writing a book on the origin and evolution of sex. He blogs at johnlogsdon.fieldofscience.com, and I shamelessly stole the subtitle of his blog for the title of this show. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, John. So, the origin of sex. How does one study that, precisely?
Well, we look at things that exist now. Biology has existed on the planet for about 3.5 billion years, but yet, as biologists, we have to look at things that exist right now. And so we look at organisms that exist right now. Sometimes we were helped by things like fossils and such, but we have to make inferences about, given the way things work now, how did they come about a long time ago?
So do you study reproduction on the genetic level?
Yeah, so I'm a molecular biologist. So in order to study sex, it's actually not as exciting as you might think sometimes. We're studying the sequences of genes that are involved in sexual reproduction. And so we do a lot of sequencing of genomes, sequencing of genes, comparing those genes amongst organisms that exist, and then asking, how did those changes in those genes come about over the long periods of time that we're looking at?
So what kinds of organisms do you study?
All kinds of organisms. So there's two basic flavors of organisms on the planet, prokaryotes, bacteria, and eukaryotes, which are organisms that have their DNA separated as part of the cell, part of the nucleus, and they usually have their DNA in separate chromosomes. So the two flavors of organisms are prokaryotes and eukaryotes, and the kind of organisms that we work on are eukaryotes. But not all eukaryotes are big organisms like animals, plants, and fungi. Many eukaryotes are also single-celled microbes, in some ways similar to bacteria. They're usually bigger. Those are the organisms that we work on. Eukaryotes.
So right. So on a genetic level, how does sexual reproduction work?
Right. So usually when we're talking about sex, we're talking about the getting together of two genetic units, or they act to bring those two things together. Sometimes we're talking about that. But there's another part to that, which is to create those genetic units that can be combined. So what we actually study in my group, and what I'm particularly interested in as a research area, is the special kind of cell division called meiosis, which divides eukaryotic genetic material in half. So if you're a female, you make eggs. If you're a male, you make sperm. And it's that division, that meiosis division, that's the genetic basis for having what are called diploid cells that have two copies of everything into haploids so that they can come back together and make a new organism.
And so how does that differ exactly from asexual reproduction?
So asexual reproduction, a lot of organisms do asexual reproduction, and it's called mitosis in eukaryotes. And basically what it is you make a copy of yourself, right? So in fact, cloning, which we're quite familiar with in the media anyway, is actually asexual reproduction. And so you're essentially taking all of the genetic material of a given organism, making a copy of it, and making another organism. And some organisms are capable of doing this. Some organisms are capable of switching between the two ways of doing it, sexual and asexual. And I'm particularly interested in those kind of organisms as well.
So are there other options than asexual and sexual?
Changing back over to bacteria a little bit. So bacteria actually, I would say, don't really do sex, although some smart people would argue with me on this point. They do what I call ad hoc sex. They can exchange one gene at a time, or two genes at a time, or three genes at a time. Whereas if you're a eukaryote and you're dividing into, say, sperm and eggs, which you're essentially having your genetic material and sort of combining the whole thing all at once. So yeah, there's intermediate ways of doing it, although eukaryotes tend to do it all at once or not at all.
So going back to the origin of sex, what's the best current guess about the first time that happened?
So time is kind of obscure to most people, including me. I mean, we're talking about life on the planet about 3.5 billion years ago. Mm-hmm. Eukaryotes there's evidence for eukaryotes about 2 billion years. Okay. And what we've done in the last few years in my group is to look at all these genes that are involved in sexual reproduction and ask if there are any organisms that exist today that are eukaryotes that don't have these genes. And the surprising answer actually to us was that we weren't able to find any existing group of organisms, eukaryotes, that don't have these genes. So it would suggest that being a eukaryote means being sexual, being able to do meiosis. And so that puts it on or about 2 billion years, although we don't have fossil evidence for the most part for these things. So there's a big window in terms of our ability to make a precise estimate. But the general answer is that it's part and parcel of being a eukaryote, which is a nucleated cell.
So what time, given that time period, what kind of organism would have done it first?
Right. So amoebae, okay, which is the show is extraordinarily timely today because the genome of a really interesting organism appeared in the journal Cell today, an organism called Naegleria gruberi, which is an organism that is an amoeba. We've all heard about amoebae. Mm-hmm. But it also is a flagellate. It can switch between amoeboid state, crawling, right, and a flagellate, which can create these parts that let them swim. And so most eukaryotes, certainly the earliest divergences, the earliest kind of eukaryotes, were either one or the other, or maybe both. And so so that early eukaryotic organism had a nucleus. It had things like mitochondria, probably. It had things like parts of cells that we think are eukaryotic. And that was probably the first organism that also was capable of having sexual reproduction.
Now, that's definitely one version of sexual reproduction. So how long did it take for sex to evolve into what it is now when we think about, mammals and such?
Right. So, again, the times, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the times because we don't really have a lot of fossil evidence in some cases for some of these what we call deep splits. We can use molecules as estimators of that time, and there's a bit of controversy. I mean, this is good. This is science. We don't know all the answers all the time. We have estimates of answers usually, and so animals probably emerged on the scene, depending on who you ask, somewhere between 1 billion and 0.5 billion years ago, and other multicellular organisms that we're familiar with, like fungi, like plants, on or about that same amount of time. So. We're usually talking about the sexes. We're talking about big organisms. We're talking about the organisms that we can see, multicellular organisms. So, so the answer is that the earliest kind of sex, meiosis, evolved very, very early. The elaborations, sperm and egg, for example, may have evolved separately a few times. What we call anisogamy. So gametes are different sizes. Eggs are big, sperm are small. So that's probably evolved a couple of times, many times maybe. So 1 billion years or sooner.
So that sounds like a rather clear stage. And although you don't know exactly when that would have occurred, are there other stages that it might have gone through?
Certainly when I began thinking about this problem, I wanted to consider the possibility that we could find an organism or groups of organisms that did it in a different way. That is, that meiosis as we know it today, just for a second, let me just say that this particular kind of cellular division is extraordinarily similar between animals, including us, fruit flies, worms, fungi, baker's yeast, I like to call it brewer's yeast, plants, corn, soybeans, etc. That's a billion years of evolution, yet in many, many ways, those molecules, the processes that meiosis uses, are actually very, very similar, which is, you know, suggests that, okay, that process is very similar. So what I began to ask was, are there versions of this process that predate that are different?
Mm-hmm.
And so far, as we know, we haven't found any evidence for it. So it might be that what works in animals, plants, and fungi is more or less the way it worked at the earliest kind of eukaryote that was capable of doing sexual reproduction.
So what advantages does sexual reproduction have over asexual reproduction, other than the obvious?
Well, I always like to say that most organisms do it when things are bad.
Really?
We might be the exception. Okay.
Okay.
So when things are good, you know, human beings celebrate, right? And one of the things we often do is have sex. Well, mostly in most organisms, they're having sex when it's sort of a last ditch thing.
Really?
Right. So yeah. Right. So when you find if you're able to grow mitotically, you can just divide and make more of yourself. Things must be pretty good, right? If you can grow well, things must be pretty darn good, right? So if things get real bad, one of the things you might do is kind of do, you know, sort of mix things up. And so that's essentially how sex is triggered in many organisms. So many organisms trigger sex by starvation, otherwise bad environmental conditions, et cetera. And so, sex is a way to escape conditions in many ways. So that's one advantage. So I call the way that, you know, that sex has persisted, I group them into sort of three categories. The good being, if you're sexual, you can make more variation, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's some dispute about whether that's a major effect. The bad, which is that if you don't have sex, you actually accumulate lots and lots of mutations. Think about it like a Xerox copy. Right. If you have a Xerox copy, you make a copy of it, looks pretty good. You make another copy of it, looks just ever so slightly worse. But if you do it many, many times, eventually you get mutations and they accumulate. Without sex, you can't actually correct that.
Right.
Okay. And then the ugly, which is organisms are in a constant battle with their environment. Right. So in the ugly part is a specific kind of environment, is that we're in constant battle with a particular environmental character, which are parasites. So if parasites are also biological organisms, they're evolving. One way to keep up with the parasites is to have sex and keep shuffling the deck every time. So the parasites don't really know where we're going, right? So that's the sort of ugly part is you're trying to keep up with those parasites, and that's called, often grouped in this category, called the Red Queen. So you're running very fast to keep up with your parasites. So those are sort of the three general reasons why sex persists. Or why sex is good.
Now, okay, that's fascinating. You've just blown my mind, sir. Just so we're clear.
Okay.
So are the changes from combining different genomes generally more beneficial than random mutations in a single genome?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
So one of the things about sex is that it's generally within a species, right? So the definition of what we think a species is, as in who can mate with whom, is part and parcel of sexual reproduction. So if you have too much variation, okay, so you have a horse and a donkey, right? They're pretty close, but if they mate, they make a mule, right? Which doesn't work sexually, right? So
right.
They're sterile. So mixing up things when they're too far apart just doesn't really work very well. right? So so that's one side of it. The other part is how using increasing the genetic variation within a species. So there's both a barrier to lots and lots, to having too much variation, but then there's also the I'm not probably explaining this very well. Within a species, sexual reproduction sort of allows a sort of checking to make sure that there's not too much variation.
Okay, now that's interesting. We actually have a related question from the website.
What does the Red Queen hypothesis, natural selection arising from co-evolutionary interactions with other species, suggest about the evolution of sexual reproduction in humans, or is the environment a more important factor?
So I'm going to probably disappoint everybody to say that probably sex in humans is not particularly biologically interesting from an evolutionary standpoint.
Okay.
But the Red Queen, I did mention the Red Queen. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're kind of stuck. Actually, people like me that have Y chromosomes are actually really stuck because we can't make babies. People like Desiree, who have two X chromosomes, potentially can clone.
Thank you for acknowledging my X chromosomes.
Yes. Okay, good. So the fact is that that we're kind of stuck in our genetics. We're obligate sexual reproducers, right? And so the red queen doesn't do so much to maintain sex in us because we have no other choice, right? So this red queen idea is, well, you're having sex to keep up with your host, really only works in a situation where organisms have an option to go asexual or sexual. Okay, right. So as human beings, we don't have much choice. Now, there are lots of organisms have options, right? So there's even vertebrate organisms that are capable of asexual reproduction. Unfortunately, to the guys out there, it's only in the girls, right? Because eggs actually have nutritive quality, right? So if you're going to do asexual reproduction, it all goes through the female line. It's not particularly easy, but usually these things are sort of short-lived because of all this Xerox copy business, among other things.
Okay, now you keep mentioning, male and female, and most people we're used to talking about sex in that way. But does that dichotomy actually hold up on a genetic level?
There's a lot of organisms that have two sexes. It's the and in some organisms we just call them plus and minus, kind of boring. But there are some organisms that have more than two sexes. When they're plus and minus, we call them mating types. If you think about it, you might have situations where mating type 1 might be able to go with mating type 3, but not with mating type 2. And mating type 2 might be able to go with mating type 4. So all of a sudden now, you've got this other complication about sex, is that you have to find a mate. And that's a cost, potentially, right? Mm-hmm. And so, it turns out that even though there are, biology is interesting, right? There are lots of exceptions to rules. It often is the case that there's about two sexes in many organisms. It's the simplest solution to accomplish this constraint, which is and task really of a benefit, as I've argued already, mm-hmm. To do sexual reproduction when you've got two kinds.
So wouldn't three or four kinds be better?
Not if you're the fourth kind and can't find the specific one kind. I mean, yeah, it might be in certain situations, and depending on the biology of the organism, depending on the ecology of the organisms, depending on the genetics, right? Let's say having four or five sexes might be okay. If you don't find a mate, you just reproduce asexually. That might work. So there are lots of interesting biology that can emerge in any individual case. But it is true that it very often is two sexes.
Well, if sex is so beneficial, then why didn't the sexually reproducing organisms sort of squeeze out the ones that reproduce asexually?
They did. But...
Well, then.
They did.
Okay.
Right? So sex is incredibly widespread in eukaryotes, and this is the issue. But the interesting bit is that asexual reproduction is actually easier and better. Okay? If you're a female and you can reproduce and you're doing well, I So if you can do well and you can reproduce asexually, and you're going to make two offspring, right? You can make two offspring that are identical to you. If you're sexual, you can only reproduce one that's identical to you, one daughter, let's say, because you're going to have to combine your genetic material with some dude who's going to give you half of the DNA in your offspring, right? If you're good, why are you going to mix your DNA with another organism?
It's a
right?
question so, we ask ourselves all the time.
Right, but that is the crux. Is that for every if you're a female and you can reproduce asexually, you can reproduce twice as fast at every generation. And if you do the math, it takes pretty short period of time to win.
So what role did sexual reproduction play in driving organisms to becoming more complex and more diverse?
I think a lot. The concept that we have of speciation, I've mentioned it in the context of mules, for example. You know, the fact that two closely related organisms essentially split to the extent that they now no longer can reproduce is actually completely tied up in sexual reproduction. So when we think about the diversity on Earth and different species, that came about in part because sexual reproduction is a kind of precise thing, right? If you have two organisms that are genetically different and then they try to mate, things don't work out sometimes. And then they're species. Now they're separate. And now they've split. And once they've split, they're different. They evolve on their own paths. And then they split again. And so I think that certainly this whole concept of biodiversity is all tied up in being eukaryotic. We take for granted, I think, this underlying genetic mechanism, which is sex and meiosis, to the diversification of species.
So you don't think that we would have the kind of complex biosphere that we have now if sexual reproduction hadn't appeared?
We wouldn't be talking about it, but I mean, right? We'd all be prokaryotes. I mean, bacteria are quite complex. I want to give props to bacteria. I mean,
that may be the first shout out to bacteria.
Yeah,
that was
absolutely
great.
Okay. In terms of number of cells, they're winning. But on the other hand, and in many cases, they can be quite complex. Bacteria can form sort of multicellular structures. But as far as we know, they aren't thinking and they aren't talking and they aren't, on a radio show. So I think there are some certain emergent properties like multicellularity. You know, we segregate our germline. We have separate cells that make our sex cells. Those are all parts of things that wouldn't happen if there weren't sexual reproduction. So I think certainly there's a lot to be said about both the eukaryotic cell and sexual reproduction for life on Earth as it is, and us.
You're very diplomatic. So, what percentage would you say? And I don't even know if you're able to hazard a guess about this. But what percentage of species reproduce sexually versus asexually?
I'll hazard a guess. What the heck?
Okay.
We're talking about eukaryotes now. Most eukaryotes are, well, I would say all eukaryotes I've studied so far, which is a pretty good sample, are capable of sexual reproduction. I've not found to my mind, a convincing example of an organism that is only capable of reproducing asexually. Now, this is a really interesting question. Are there any organisms that only reproduce asexually? And if so, then how do they persist? With all these disadvantages of asexuality, mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that most organisms reproduce sexually all the time. I mean, most organisms are reproducing asexually when things are good. You know, things are good. Divide, make a copy of yourself. So many organisms, we aren't comfortable thinking about that ourselves as much, but most organisms are capable of alternating between sexual and asexual reproduction. So I'd say I'd like to find an organism that is totally incapable of reproducing sexually, because I want to use that as a counterexample to then understand, well, why why in the heck are organisms reproducing sexually if this one can get away with it? And in my lab, we're studying organisms that are sort of the best candidates for that. And these are the so-called the delayed rotifers, which are all female group of microbial animals, small animals.
We have a question from the website.
What is the weirdest form of reproduction that you've encountered?
And it also states, I'm really hoping he talks about bat bugs.
So I knew a little bit about bat bugs. And bat bugs are relatives of bed bugs. And bed bugs, I know a little bit about bed bugs. And I looked up a little bit paper on bat bugs. And what they do is they have what's called traumatic insemination. Okay, sounds traumatic. Mm-hmm. So for the females, instead of having a vagina, let's say, a receptive part of her body, the male just stabs his penis into the body. They have a hemiseal, which is the sort of circulatory system, and stabs the body and inseminates the body, and then the sperm makes it to the reproductive tract. Mm-hmm. It sounds awful, doesn't it? So bed bugs are known for this, and it turns out bat bugs are also known for this. There's some really interesting stuff that has evolved what we call conflicts, right? So what happens is, if you have, if in a species the male is doing this traumatic insemination, that might lead to a countermeasure on the female's part to come up with, something that would ameliorate to make that not so bad. So there's lots of interesting sort of what we call arms races between the males and the females, and for the bat bugs, they've evolved. They can't even tell whether they're males or females when they start, because they have appendages that don't distinguish them, because their issues of trying to sort of battle this phenomenon. So there's just, that's not even the weirdest thing out there, but bed bugs and bat bugs are pretty cool.
Okay,
think the weirdest thing is, my favorite are these organisms called spoonworms. And these are invertebrate animals. And the male is relegated to essentially what evolutionarily a male is usually relegated to, unless you're talking about a social organism, which is making sperm. And it turns out the male is something like 10,000 times smaller than the female, and degenerates and basically attaches near her genital opening, and basically is attached there for life, only making sperm for his entire existence. So that to me is sort of the most unusual and interesting, and sort of illustrates the idea of, well, what are males good for? Well, you guess.
Today I wish we had video, because everybody in the studio right now has an absolutely horrified expression on their face.
You realize I get credit for saying this as a man.
Oh, my. Okay. And when that individual sent in that question on the website about the bat bugs, I had to go look it up. And, so I made the face then as well. But the first thing I thought is, why would an organism evolve like that initially? Why would the male, why?
Yeah. Battle of the sexes. I don't know the natural history of the group. I should know more about this particular group. But male and female are in this constant battle, right? So females want to find the best males. Males want to mate as many times as they can, usually, in most organisms, right? Sperm are cheap, eggs are expensive. That's a sort of general idea. It doesn't always hold, but it's a good sort of starting point to think about things. And the elaborations, this enforced sexual reproduction, the elaborations of how it's all done is highly dependent on the biology of the organisms. So, whether there's polygamy, polygyny, et cetera. So are you having multiple male mates, or are the males, have a harem? So all of these issues have to, the evolution sort of responds to what's going on biologically. If if you're in a system where the females are mating with many, many males, you can imagine that if you're a male, having an intermittent organ, a penis, that scrapes out the stuff from the guy before might be beneficial.
Right.
And it turns out many, many insects have penises like this that that are, you know, trying to give them the advantage. So there's lots of interesting biology that comes out just because of this battle of the sexes and trying to get, moving one's genes on to the next generation.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll talk to Jonathan Strickland, tech blogger and podcaster for How Stuff Works. We'll discuss the gadgets employed by the self-proclaimed ghost hunters and why critical thinking is an important aspect to examining tech trends. And on Speaking Up, Skept parent blogger Tyson Wozniak talks about raising the next generation of critical thinkers. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we have some audience questions from the website.
Where do you see sex going in the future? Will having babies in test tubes someday approach the norm?
Yes. As I mentioned to Desiree, I mean, I think, there are ethical issues with cloning. I mean, we can clone many mammals now. So I think... certainly one's ability to certainly test tube babies generally are, combining, sort of sexual reproduction in a tube. But I think that cloning is certainly going to be an issue. However, there's some really interesting, not only ethical issues, but biological issues about cloning. There are some elaborate genetic elaborations that sometimes means that cloning kind of messes up the genetic material. And so even though they're genetically identical, there are things called epigenetics that might silence genes and turn genes off or on that might mean that, that cloning is not so good. I mean, we've seen this happen in some other organisms. So I think we're going to be doing it for a long time, but there are probably going to be some alternate ways to continue our species.
Well put, sir. We have another one from the site.
I've heard that redheads face extinction. Is this true? If so, how can we stop it from happening? What about skin color? I've heard it said in the future that we will all look the same. Is that true?
Oh, heavy sigh.
Oh boy. So these are human genetics questions, not so much about sex, but you got to get there via sex. Skin color is an interesting question, so I'll go to that one first. So skin color is a multigenic trait. And many multigenic traits, like height, right? Mm-hmm. You create distributions, right? So if you're, since it's many genes that contribute to it, if you mate a short man and a tall woman or vice versa, the kids on average will be medium height, right? But there'll be a distribution. And so over time, these so-called quantitative traits, sort of move to sort of a highly frequent intermediate state. And so if there's what we call panmixis, lots of mating sort of randomly among, let's say, skin color of people, on average, people will be mostly brown at some point, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long that'll take. What we have in among our own species is what we call positive assortative mating. Brown people tend to mate with brown people and white with white more often than not, more often than other. I'm not putting a value judgment. I'm just saying, culturally, that's often what happens. So when those cultures break down, perhaps there's going to be more and more. I think I don't know how long that'll take. Skin color is really not particularly itself all that interesting biologically. It certainly doesn't determine all the things that we, you know, some people think it does.
Right.
With regard to hair color, it's more, I think it's a little bit more interesting question. There are fewer genes of major effect that I'm aware of, right? And so, like, my mom's a redhead, but I'm a blonde, right? And so, I don't think we risk losing redheads. but I don't know. I mean, it all depends on the effect and the frequency of genes that are for black hair, brown hair, and how they interact with blonde hair and redheads. So I think, you know, we're a beautifully diverse species, and I just there's lots of genetic variation, and unless there's a detrimental side to being a redhead or a blonde or whatever, I think we'll probably be pretty diverse and look, you know, to the outside to be quite different for a long time.
All right, and a question from the chat room.
Question is, what's the deal with the all-female lizards?
Yeah!
All right.
So it's the classic case for vertebrates. And there was just a paper out last week in Nature that basically gave us a huge hint. So here's the deal. They're called whiptail lizards. And they're parthenogens. The females make females, you know. So, we know of organisms that do this. But the key is that the parthenogens that they produce, their offspring, are genetically diverse. What usually happens with an asexual organism is they get less and less diverse over time, right? Mm-hmm. These organisms seem to stay diverse. How in the heck did that happen? The interesting thing is this paper that came out last week showed, I think pretty darn convincingly, that they have figured out how to subvert meiosis, this thing I talked about at the beginning, the sort of standard division that creates gametes, mm-hmm. in a way that, in a very unique way, such that the gametes that come out, or that is the offspring, are genetically diverse. They maintain their diversity from the mother rather than making it more similar due to effects of meiosis. So it's a little bit complicated story. It's hard to explain on the radio. But basically, by subverting meiosis, they've figured out how to make daughters that are also genetically diverse rather than being genetically less diverse.
I could make so many jokes right now, and I'm totally not going to.
Go for it.
No. Moving along, we have another website question.
Sounds good.
If you could eliminate just one of the myths surrounding sex and replace it with the glorious facts, what would it be?
Wow, you guys have tough questions. Myths about sex. I'm going to put that on the back burner and ask for another question, and I'll try to get back to it. Let me just – I can put it on the back burner for a little bit, can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll do it.
Yep.
Hey, question from the chat room is there a relationship between being sexual or asexual and complexity?
Yeah, another hard and good question. So we talked about this early on, is that I think there is an aspect of complexity that requires sexual reproduction. I think the multicellular thing that eukaryotes do was dependent on this sort of pre-existence of sexual reproduction. So there are other aspects. So complexity is a weird thing. It's sort of in the eye of the beholder. Like I said, there are prokaryotes or bacteria that make complex multicellular structures. So I think complexity per se doesn't require sexual reproduction, but I think that some things that we know of being complex are benefited by and can take advantage of the kind of shuffling and natural selection being able to act on different combinations of genes in a more robust and frequent way to build new things. So I don't think it's always necessary, but it certainly has helped a lot.
Okay, we have just enough time for one more question.
Okay.
So you either have a choice between the myth question or a creationist question.
Oh, let's go. As much as I'm going to love the myth question, which I don't have an answer for yet, by the way. Let's go for the creationist question. What the heck?
All right. Creationists, they like to point to sexual reproduction as evidence against evolution, correct?
Yeah, but I've never quite figured out what they're getting at.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What is their argument exactly?
I think it's a complexity argument. I think it's this general thing, is that you can't build something out of nothing. And the fact is that that is what biology does. It starts with things and it builds on other things. And so my understanding, at least some of the arguments I've seen, is it's sort of the same argument as the evolution of the eye or the evolution of other complex things, that you can't imagine it working halfway. And which is completely bogus, right? You know, the evolution of the eye is a classic example where you can see a progression of cells that are light sensitive to a pit to blah 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 blah. You know, you can move it all the way through. If you want to learn about that stuff, go look at among other people, Todd Oakley at UCSB works on this stuff. Complexity can be selected in a piecemeal way. Meiosis and sex are one of those things that's sort of hard. You know, you got an endpoint. How did you get there? And so I think that's one of the things that I've sort of heard argued. But the fact is that even prokaryotes, bacteria, do at some level, I don't want to call it sex, but they do recombination. They shuffle genes in the DNA using enzymes that are absolutely homologous. They descend from a common ancestor to the same genes that are involved in eukaryotes to do the same thing in meiotic sexual reproduction. So, that idea, Given a specific question, I can't address it, but I've heard that sort of general complaint about sexual reproduction in the context of complexity, and it's an extraordinarily easy answer.
So everything that we've discussed on the show today is going to be in your book, right?
Yeah, and some other stuff, I hope.
Okay. Wonderful. I'm very much looking forward to it. We are absolutely out of time. Thank you
very much.
So much, John, for being on the show.
It's been a great pleasure.
And it was a lot less dirty than I thought it would be.
Oh, darn.
We'll have to do a part two.
All right, sounds good.
So you can find out more from John Logsdon at johnlogsdon.fieldofscience.com. And you can find out more from us at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, do click the links that take you to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you.